It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
Alrighty, welcome to another edition of the Radio Hour. It is Matt Wardlaw, your usual ringleader for these festivities. And right off the bat, I'd like to invite you to email us here at feedback@mattandjeff.net. And if this is your first time listening to the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour, surf on over to mattandjeff.net to check out the archive of all the episodes that we've done up to this point, including recent episodes with drummer extraordinaire Kenny Aronoff, Bill Payne of Little Feet, and our new best friend, Emily Hurd. And if reading printed interviews is more of your thing, we have those too. Jeff recently spoke with the great David Sanborn, and in that vein, I'd love to invite you to go a little bit further back and read my interview with former Tonight Show bandleader Kevin Eubanks. You'll find both those interviews over at PopDose.com, and there are just plenty of good things all the time for you to consume over there at PopDose. And since I mentioned him, joining me for today's festivities is a man who carries a unique amount of love for music featuring bagpipes with him everywhere that he goes, my beloved comrade Jeff Giles. How are you, sir?
I keep telling you, that's the Ebo. Not the bagpipe.
One of these days, I'll get that right, Jeff. You know, I mean, you have to realize that, first of all, I bought the domain for mattandjeff.net and then proceeded to go, like, the next five episodes without using it. So I figured I would just start small by actually using things we pay for.
Making our investments pay off.
Getting details right, that's next on my list. But, you know, small steps,
don't.
Baby steps. Well, today we're going to be speaking with singer-songwriter Joy Ike about her new album, All or Nothing, which it's her third full-length release, capturing 10 songs, it says, about giving up everything that you have in exchange for everything you need. And that is something cool to think about right there. The bio on Joy's website sets things up really nicely, noting that Ike is not yet a veteran, but more than a newcomer. And it's hard to put Ike's music into a specific genre, which is what we really enjoyed about her music and her self-described anywhere for anyone approach, which has found her playing theaters, house shows, coffee houses, churches, and colleges. Incidentally, Jeff has been thrown out of all of those places at least once.
It's true.
But that's not the point. That's really not the point. It is all about Joy Ike on today's Radio Hour, and we are thrilled to have her with us. Welcome, Joy. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's jump into things real quick and talk about the new record, All or Nothing, which is a great, great collection of songs. Can you just tell us a little bit about how this new album came together for you?
Yeah, I had been writing songs. I put out my my last album, the one before that, in 2010. And I guess as it goes for me, as soon as an album comes out, it's almost like the floodgates open and I can start writing again. You know, it's like for a while, all of a sudden, everything just stops up because I have all these songs that need to actually physically get out there. So once I put out the last album, I just started writing for about 2.5-3 years while touring and doing a number of other things. And come beginning of 2012, I had pretty much all the songs, about 80% or 90% of the songs for the new album. And I just spent a lot of time looking for a producer to work with, and I kind of envisioned how I wanted the album to sound, and the fact that I really wanted the production level to go up for the new project, a little bit higher than the last few albums. So for me, I think the major key for working on this new album was finding a producer that that I could work, you know, would have a really great relationship with and who would understand what exactly I was going for. So I would say it was probably, all from top to bottom, was probably a 3-3.5 year process from writing to actually putting out something.
Wow.
Well, when it comes to writing, I've read you talk about how you don't write a lot. You write, I think you said 5 or 6 songs a year. And
yeah,
I wanted to talk about that and get into the reasons for that. You know, if it's because you kind of let your ideas brew for a while before you try putting them to music, or because mm-hmm. you edit a lot, or what the songwriting process is like for you.
Yeah, I mean, truly, I probably, at the most, I've probably written in any given year 7 songs, but it does average around 5 or 6 songs a year. And for me, it does. It really takes several months for a song to actually fully form. You know, there will be ideas that will be brewing for a while, and the things that will pop up here and there. And I think so usually, you know, a song is, you know, how there's like that, the hay that breaks the camel's back. I don't know if I even said that expression right, but there's always that one moment where I'm just like, okay, the song is ready to finally, you know, come out or begin to be heard, by myself, you know, but in that process, in the months coming up, going up to, or leading up to that point, there are so many things that play into a song actually existing. And I think for this album, specifically because it's a love album, there were so many, you know, emotions and, you know, experiences that were happening for me in the course of those few years that kind of culminated into this project. But for me, I think it just takes a while for things to actually boil to the point where they actually need to come out. And then, you know, when they do come out, they go through this process of, you know, playing a little bit, writing some words, playing a little bit more, and making that all happen. And eventually, you know, you go into the studio, you record it, and the recording process ultimately changes how you play things at a live show too. So, right. So I think it's just a process that continues to evolve over the years.
Within that process, is there any part of it where you feel blocked up as far as writing?
I would say the hardest part of the process for me is actually being in the studio. Yeah, you know, for me, I think one of the reasons why I do write very few songs is because I don't ever want to force anything. So, you know, for me, if I'm at a piano and something's not coming, then I'll leave the song and I'll return the following day, or I'll leave it and come back, you know, a week or a month later. So I honestly never really feel any hurry to write a song, because I do want it to be authentic, and I don't want to write something and say something that's already been said. But I strongly feel that there is nothing new under the sun, you know, and you there are, it's really hard to say something new. So my goal when I write is not to say something new, but to say it in a way that it hasn't been said yet. And so I think that's why it just takes me a while to like let ideas simmer and let them form in a way that's unique and different. And so for me, like I was saying earlier, the hardest part is being in the studio, mostly because I don't consider myself a session musician in any way. And if I had it my way, I would just be a songwriter and a singer and a songwriter. But I think the piano is just a, you know, a tool that makes everything a little bit easier. So being in the studio, there's just so many choices, you know, what drums you want to use, what sound you're actually going for in a specific second of a song, and there's so many ways you can record one song, any given song, and those options, they seriously overwhelm me.
All right, well, I want to ask about something you just said. You know, what keeps you from just being a songwriter?
Well, when I first started, I knew that was my goal. Like, I knew that I really wanted to be a lyricist, and I wanted to be someone who kind of painted with their words. But I had grown up taking piano lessons for so long, and I found that it was just easier to come up with words whenever I was on the piano. And I think, too, when starting out and even now, it's still so much more advantageous to be able to play your own songs and kind of be, I don't know, self-sufficient is kind of something that's frowned on, and you know, I don't think of myself as self-sufficient by any means, but to be in a place where you can hit the road and tour and be able to support yourself when playing.
I want to go back for a minute to what you were saying about the studio, because we talk a lot on this show to artists about the sort of tyranny of choice that technology has given artists that are recording now, you know, along the lines of what you were saying, that it's easy to get lost in the lack of boundaries that the studio has as an instrument now. And we also talk a lot about the idea that limitations define style. And so, you know, given that you've struggled and sensibly so, I think, with the way recording is now, I wonder how you shaped your own style, because it's awfully unique.
When I returned to piano, and this was probably my final year in college, it's probably been about 8 or 9 years, It was really, I mean, music was a blank slate to me. There was, you know, there's a little bit of lingering music theory here and there from what I was taught as a kid, from the lessons my parents made me take. But for the most part, it was a blank slate. And so for me, when I started to write songs, every new song was kind of like, it was really, really like a new canvas, you know, and it was me kind of creating music outside of a box and not really using any type of music theory to create the songs, but, you know, hearing this right. melody in my head and figuring out, okay, how can I actually, like, translate that and make my fingers play what exactly I heard in my head. So it was a back and forth process, and you know, probably that's probably another one of the reasons why songs don't come out as much, because when I hop onto a piano, it's not like all of a sudden these melodies start to pour out. For me, it's got to be some tune that I've already started to kind of work in my head and has been kind of boiling for a bit. So for me, it was just returning to the piano over and over again, not to practice any type of technique and not to practice I was just going to the piano because it's like, you know, I want to write songs. So I would honestly say the first 3 years of my music career, quote unquote, was really a practice session. You know, it was really just figuring out my sound. And even still, I would say that it wasn't until the fourth or fifth year of playing that I actually figured out what it was I sound like.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we've talked about bits and pieces of this, but I do want to, you know, just ask one more thing about your songwriting method, and that is, you know, for you, you know, what are the most important elements for you in a song, and I guess marks that you look to hit?
Well, whenever I'm listening to music, I, you know, the most important thing to me is a good voice and great lyrics. And I say that because I feel like there's just so much music out there, and there's so many artists, and given the fact that we have a platform by default, you know, we're on stage and people are actually listening to us, I think what we say has a lot, carries a lot of weight, especially for people, and, you know, people who are looking for quote unquote role models, you know, not that I claim to be one or anything, but I think, when you have that attention of people, there's kind of a responsibility with what it is that you say. And so basically I feel like whenever, you know, because that's what I look for and that's what I love when I listen to music, that's also what I want to be whenever I'm creating music for people. And so if I could just have, you know, a guy with a guitar or a girl on the piano and, you know, go to concerts like that, I mean, I'd pick that over listening to bands any night of the week.
Well, I want to ask you about this, about the new record, and just as far as you paired up with Saul Simon McWilliams for this one. You know, what did he bring to the table, and how did he really help you mold this stuff?
Yeah, you know, working with Saul Simon has probably been one of the best experiences of my music journey so far. I had just spent several months just sitting and listening to music of independent artists and trying to get a feel of the producer they worked with and what that producer brought to the table as far as their music went. And there was one artist I was listening to out of New York City, and something about her album just stuck out to me. So I shot her an email and just asked her if she could tell me more about her recording experience and her relationship with Saul Simon, and it ended up that she connected us after a couple weeks, and he and I talked a little bit and just decided, okay, what is it that you want from the album, what can I bring to the table, and, you know, how we could work together to kind of just make it a mutually good experience. And there were a couple things I was looking for with the producer. Was one, I was looking for someone that I knew that I could communicate well with, because I tend to communicate in picture, you know, and I'll say something like, well, I want this song to sound like we're walking through a field of flowers or something. And I was like, I just need to find someone who understands, like, how I talk, so they can, like, you know, take that image and turn it into a sound. So working with Saul was a really great experience, and there were just times when he would just be bluntly honest with me and just be like, no, that's not going to happen. And I think in many of my like recording experiences in the back, in the past, it's been hard to find people who, you know, will be completely honest, who are completely confident in their ability to produce an album, but at the same time also not afraid to tell you whatever your idea is bad, in order to like make the album as good as it can be. So I think that's what I really appreciated most about him.
And Matt and I just talked with an artist who described the producer on his most recent record as a goalie, blocking his potential mistakes from getting through the net, you know.
That's crazy.
Interesting story, the way you found your producer, because I think a lot of people still operate under that old idea of a producer being somebody that is sort of introduced to you or kind of foisted on you by a label. But for artists in your position, you have to make those connections yourself.
Yeah. And I think that's probably, you know, I had this huge goal of putting the album out in the fall of, you know, 2012, before hitting the road and playing a lot of colleges and such. And it just didn't happen, you know, and it was so important for me to not try and hurry the album and make it happen just because I wanted to get it out there, but to wait to find the right person and just to give the album time to kind of breathe and develop organically on its own. So I think that was just one of the best things that happened. You know, the album wasn't hurried, and I think in hindsight we always have these things that when we look back on a last project, we always think, well, I could have done that better, and I could have done that better. And I'm sure I'll feel like that about this album and give it a couple more weeks. But I think that's one of the greatest things about this project was that it just happened a little bit slower, which kind of made it sound a little more whole when all was said and done.
Yeah.
Now that you're on the other side of things, what are really your favorite songs from this record?
Oh, that's the hardest question in the world. this answer changes every day, I'll tell you that. But I think that there are certain songs that I like more for their production value, and then there are certain songs that I love to play live. Right. And then other ones that I appreciate more because of the season I was in when I was writing. If I'd have to pick a few, I love playing Pick Me Up. It's just one of my favorite songs to play live.
Yeah.
I think it's just got a really cool energy behind it, you know. Home, which is the final song on the album, for me is very, you know, very close to my heart, and you know, and I think it's just one of those songs. I mean, it took me about a year and 3 months to write that.
Wow.
And I just kept going to the piano and leaving it because the words just weren't coming the right way. So for me, that song probably, I think I'm closest to that song.
How do you really work past that when you're in that situation? I mean, that just seems like that would get frustrating at points.
Oh yeah, it definitely does get frustrating. I mean, if it happens for too long, you know, I'll just drop the song. You know, I won't return to it at all. But with Home, for example, I think I just I had the chorus for that song first, and every time I sang the chorus, I was just like, this song needs to happen. It just needed to happen, and so I knew. That was probably, you know, after that was happening for a couple of weeks, I knew that I just couldn't work on it anymore. So I probably let it go for about 3 or 4 months, and then returned, and then had another 3 or 4 month block somewhere in there and returned and worked on it again. So, if I kind of start to hit like a roadblock, I'll just give it even more space than I normally would.
Have you done a lot of co-writing is that any kind of aid at all when it comes to getting around blocks like that?
No, you know what? I've never done co-writing. I have a lot of friends who do a lot of co-writing and who hit up Nashville a lot and work with their friends and artists in the area. And I have mixed feelings about it. It's hard for me to kind of really decide how I would feel about it because I've never been in that situation. But I also feel like all of the songs that I'm writing are coming from these deeply personal places, and I think to a certain point or extent, I might, this sounds terrible, but I might just be a little too selfish to share a song with someone. I don't know. Cause for me, it's kind of a little bit of an emotional experience too, you know? And I think because songs don't come that often for me, they're even more sacred than they would be, you know, if they were to come weekly, or, you know, if I were to write a song every 2 or 3 weeks or something.
That's very easy to understand.
thank you for making me feel better.
Even for me, it's easy to understand.
you use the phrase mixed feelings, and I feel like that makes this a good time to talk about the Kickstarter component of this record, because we've talked to a lot of artists who have mixed emotions about that whole method of fundraising for an album's production. And we would like to get a feel for your experiences in that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, this is my second time doing a Kickstarter. I honestly love Kickstarter. I know there are so many new platforms out there, like Indiegogo and a couple others. But I just, I love what Kickstarter's doing, and I love that they were one of the people that spearheaded this whole fan funding, crowdfunding movement. From the perspective of, you know, my fans and their willingness to support the project, it's funny because I feel like even if I were in a place where I was able to financially to fund an album solely by myself, I think at this point I would probably still do a Kickstarter, because it was just kind of interesting to see how people were so much more interested and so much more engaged in the process of the album because they were financially invested in it. It's almost like they became emotionally invested in it. Mm-hmm. And so it's, when the album came out, they were just so much more excited for it to exist, and so much more excited about sharing it with their friends. And it's one of those things too where you feel awkward asking for money, because it does put you in a very vulnerable place, and especially with the Kickstarter model where if you don't reach the whole goal, you don't get any of it.
Right.
You almost have to be an advertiser and really just push for people to support. But I think the great thing about that is that whenever you do make that goal, it lets you know that what you're doing, it kind of justifies it, you know, and lets you know that what you're doing is worth it. And that's what I love most about Kickstarter. And I just feel so blessed by all the people who have really contributed to my last two projects, knowing that, you know, they want this to keep going and they think it's worth investing their time and money and interest in.
I think it does help foster more of an emotional bond with the music, and that's something that God knows we could use more of these days.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite thing about it is that it reintroduces the element of anticipation. You know, you contribute to a record and you're going to have to wait sometimes, a year before you get it. And then when you get it's almost like, I don't know, it's like finding $5 in your pocket or something.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I really have seen it kind of just bring me closer to my fans. And last week, my sister's a drummer, and she plays with me on the road. And we hit the road, and we just couldn't find a place to stay in Richmond, Virginia. We were going down south. And I was trying to hold out, because I kind of hate asking people for favors all the time. But I was trying to hold out and putting something on Facebook. But I posted on Facebook, I was like, okay, people, we need a place to stay. We have nowhere to, we don't know anyone in Richmond, Virginia. And literally, this is no exaggeration, within 30 seconds, we had a response and a place to stay. And I was just blown away, because I've just seen how much more people are willing to help out in general, simply because they've just been a part of the process for so many years now.
I will just follow on what Jeff said as far as, you know, being a part of the, you know, the crowdfunding process. And I mean, I've said this to a few artists, but I love the whole process. Well, first of all, you know, Jeff is right. It does bring anticipation back into the process. And for me, it's like, you know, the $10 or the $15 or $20, whatever it is that I put down, you know, to pledge for the experience. You know, that's money that's out of my pocket. And then like a year later, you know, I've already got this new album that I paid for. And in a lot of cases, as much music as we're getting hit with on a daily basis, I kind of forgot mm-hmm. that I pledged for that. And I get the email, and it's like, oh, right, you know, this is coming out in 2 weeks. Oh, my God, I'm so stoked to finally hear this record. So it's just like, I think in a way it kind of brings back the experience for me of, like, when I would walk in a record store and not be aware at all that, like, you know, one of my favorite artists, you know, had put out a new record, and like, oh my God, so-and-so has a new record. Here it is. And I can take this home and listen to it right now. So, I mean, I love that part of the process. Yeah. And the other part that I love is really, I think that, you know, Jeff and I and a lot of folks, you know, growing up, you know, you always wanted to have that fly on the wall experience to be in the studio with your favorite artist and see what was going on. And now you have that chance to, like, see pictures and videos and maybe mm-hmm. hear demos from the whole process. And it's just like, as I say, like, for a record that I was going to buy anyway, it's like there's no lose mm-hmm. in investing in the process for me. I'm all about it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that. I think one of the things that people really liked about, at least people who were local, to my city, I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A lot of them in donating, you know, got tickets to the CD release, and you know, they were just like, "Well, I was gonna be there anyhow." So this is like completely win-win. You know, they get the album ahead of time, and they get a ticket to the CD release, and it was just kind of cool to for people to be excited about things like that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I just spoke with Grantley Phillips, and he did the crowdfunding mm-hmm. thing for his latest record, and one of the things that mm-hmm. he gave away as an incentive was actually his first Yamaha acoustic guitar. And I asked him about giving something away for that, giving away something like that, you know, in support of his art. You know, I said, what was that like? And so I guess what I'd like to know is, like, the stuff that you had up as incentives, are there any of the incentives that were kind of, you know, difficult for you to put out there?
Yeah, well, I had a couple things that people especially liked. I gave away my first ukulele, and for me, I'm still really new to ukulele. I've only been playing it for maybe 2 years now. And so that one, within the first, you know, couple hours of the campaign, that was gone. I saw that people really, really liked that idea. I'll start with my favorite thing to give away and then the hardest thing to give away next. My favorite was the opportunity to cook dinner for a fan, or however many fans, but only one fan wanted to go that route. And I love to cook, and I love to cook for people, for others. And for me, that's kind of like my other creative outlet outside of music. You know, it's kind of how I let loose. So I had a woman and her daughter come over for dinner one evening, and just got to know them better and got to just hang out with them. And it was funny because the daughter actually went to the high school that I grew up at.
Oh, cool.
And so we just talked about, she's in a band, I think it's an all-girl band, and it was just a fun conversation. You know, it was a little awkward at first because we didn't know each other, but it loosened up, you know, 30, 45 minutes in, and just was a really fun time. I'd say my hardest Kickstarter item to do was I have this level for this most recent Kickstarter, and the last one, to write a song for people. And it can be a song for them. It can be a song for, you know, someone, a significant other in their life or whatever. But that's always been the hardest. I had about maybe two or three with my last Kickstarter campaign, and about four or five for this Kickstarter.
Wow.
And I'm still trying to finish this. I have one more song to get through. But it's really hard for me because, like I was saying before, it's just so the songs I write always come from very personal places. So after a while, you get a little bit. I'd say I feel like I've gotten a little bit better with it in the past year or so. But just trying to put someone else's story to music, it's just been really challenging for me. But you know what? Some great songs have come out of it. The song "Time," which is on this new album, was actually a Kickstarter song for a couple in Philadelphia that I wrote.
Cool.
That was a Kickstarter reward from the last album's fundraising. So some really great things have come out of it.
It's interesting to get your perspective on that, because I just talked to a guy named Darden Smith who runs a foundation or a program called Songwriting With, where he goes around And most of what he does through that program is write songs with veterans.
Hmm.
Oh, they'll tell him their And for him, it seems like that kind of situation would be sort of a it's sort of a songwriting fuel in a way. But it sounds daunting to me. And
I think to each his own. You know, some people it's almost liberating to be able to write a song that's that you're not attached to in some way.
Right.
And I think that it really is a liberating thing. I just think I probably need a little more practice at that, you know, and need to get out of my own little world.
Matt referenced a few minutes ago the fact that we are kind of inundated with music. I think all of us are. And for guys in our position, that often comes from publicists, and
which is funny because that was my last career, actually.
That's exactly where I was going with this, because we're very interested in that part of your story. It seems like working as a publicist would be a really powerful deterrent to keep you from ever wanting or trying to record music of your own. It seems like
that's funny. I you know what, being a publicist was probably, I feel like it was the greatest thing that happened to me. I just always love to kind of help people get their stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I just feel like there's so much good stuff out there, and usually the problem isn't that you're not good enough. It's just that nobody knows that you're out there, you know?
Right. Right.
Yeah. And so I don't know. I feel like there was this point where I was working this job and doing this for other people, for authors specifically. And I just kept feeling pulled in so many ways. Like, there were a few authors that I really enjoyed working with. But then I would go home at night and I would just be at my piano. I'd be writing music and I would be booking shows and all of the above. And I got to a point where I was just like, well, you know what? I know how to do the business side of it. And I have the music. So if I can just, like, devote a year to this and give it a try, I think I can do this full time. And that was 5 years ago, and I just feel like while the road has continued to be rocky, I mean, it's just a hard way to make a living, I've become more and more passionate about sharing my music with people and also the publicity and business side of it.
Well, I think Jeff and I know too many emotionally damaged publicists, so it's good to hear that, it's good to hear that you had a positive experience out of the whole thing.
It's funny.
On the subject of marketing and promotion, your music occupies this unique territory where it's really well received critically, but it doesn't really sit square enough inside any particular genre, which we really referenced in the intro to all of this. For someone to say that, you know, Joy Ike sounds like this, you know, which is, you know, certainly a compliment to you as an artist, but it has to make things especially daunting when you're trying to build a career in this musical climate. It just seems like an artist in your position almost has to focus on television placement rather than radio ads.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because people have, for the past several years, have tried to put me in boxes, you know, and I think that's just the way it goes, you know, and everyone wants to find some way to identify you and somewhere to put you so it makes sense to them and to everyone else. But I think the one I probably run away from most is the jazz scene. I think just because there's a certain amount of dissonance in my songs and my voice kind of has that jazz soul R&B vibe, I tend to be lumped in that category on a pretty regular basis. And I'm just going to just put it on the record. I do not know anything about jazz music, and the jazz scares me. So I'm just going to let everyone listening know that. I don't ever look down on that. You know, I don't feel any certain way when people do that. I think it's just the way things need to be. It doesn't necessarily bug me that much, you know. I think music licensing is my top priority right now. And I think the songs are just very, very cinematic and very picturesque. And I think that they would complement, you know, specific television shows, movies, and commercials perfectly. I'm biased, though.
There is a certain dramatic scope to these songs. It's true. And I just wanted to go back a couple of seconds. You said something about being afraid of jazz, and I wanted to say for people who haven't heard the record that one of the unique things about your sound, and probably one of the things about your sound that causes people to sort of fall back on that jazz tag, is the fact that your band includes a cello and an upright bass.
Yeah.
Was there anything in particular that led you in that direction?
Well, cello has always been my favorite instrument for as long as I can remember. There's just something about it. It's just so beautiful. And I think they say that it is the closest instrument to the voice, in that it has just as much range as it has the lowest amount of range and the highest amount of range than any other instrument that complements the voice best. And so I don't know, maybe there's something about that has made it, you know, just the most coveted instrument for me to have on stage whenever I'm playing in full band form. But other than that, I've been playing with an upright bass player for about 3.5 years or so. And we actually met at a show. He was playing with another artist that I was actually in a competition with. And he came up after the show and asked me if I ever needed a bass player that he would love to join in on a show. And at that point, you know, my mind wasn't even thinking that I needed a bass player, because anyone that comes to a live show will know that I only play one half of my keyboard, and that's the low end. Because I love like deep bassy percussive sounds, and how I play is kind of like a Nina Simone type thing, where I'm kind of like banging the piano versus, you know, I don't know, it's very drum oriented. And so at that point I was like, I don't really think I need a bass player, because I cover the bass end so much in my songs. But we ended up working together, and I feel like that kind of just made things complete, and he brought so much to the table, and I think just complemented what I was doing so perfectly. So it's just been a really great experience to play with a bass player, and I think that just that was kind of the missing piece. So as of right now, our instrumentation is piano, percussion, upright bass, and cello. And everything kind of revolves around drums, you know, in my set. Everything's very percussive, and definitely my Nigerian heritage has a lot to do with that. And even when I'm playing solo shows, I'm always hearing drums in my head. So you'll hear an occasional vocal percussion, or I'll be, you know, banging my feet or snapping while playing, something to kind of just keep that rhythm going.
I'm always hearing drums in my head too, but it's because we talk to way too many drummers on this podcast. So you're a refreshing difference from where we usually go. But you know, I think that you just do such a great job, as we've been talking to you, like, just of illustrating, you know, why it's so important to, like, you know, remain artistically open to, like, you know, new experiences, mm-hmm. and possibilities and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think that's such a huge component of being a successful artist. And you know, you talking about, you know, taking on a bass player and, you know, not really knowing where that was going to lead. And, you know, really also, like, just some of the elements that you've employed in your, you know, Kickstarter experiences. I mean, like the experience of, like, you know, writing songs for other people and, you know, having one of those songs, you know, be one that you use on this latest record. I mean, it's just like everything that you do, I think, you know, pays a lot of dividends if you can just get out of the way and just let it.
Yeah. You're right about that. I think, especially when I first started playing out, I was incredibly overprotective of my music, you know. And I think because music is, you know, my baby, you know, and for every artist, that's like your baby. You invest so much into it, and nobody cares about it as much as you do. I think that, you know, as musicians, we have that tendency to want to hold on to it so tightly, but at the same time, that is what I've learned in the past few years, that if you just let it go, and if you just start to for one, trust other people to care about what you care about as much as you do, that, you know, when you find the right people, they will take care of it, and they won't do anything except make it better. And I think that's probably the biggest lesson I've learned in this career over the last several years.
Well, I just want to ask about something that I think is pretty cool, and that is the 365 days of all or nothing blog posts. I mean, that's a pretty extended and unique commitment to the idea of promoting your work. I mean, you've done the publicity thing. Artists do the thing where they do a weekly series of podcasts or video posts or whatever leading up to the release of their album. But I mean, that's usually like maybe a month or two. And this idea really goes beyond that. Is this an exercise for you that, you know, brings any benefits to you creatively beyond just helping you to promote your record?
Yeah, well, I feel like I'm being crazy, I should say first of all. Like, I knew it was going to be daunting, and I write this music marketing blog called Grassrootsy that I've been doing or running for the last 5 years or so. And so when this idea came of writing a daily blog, I was just like, I don't know what you're doing, what you're talking about, why are you even trying to get yourself into this mess? So it's been daunting. But I think when the idea popped in my head, I was just like, I think that there are so many things that I come across and want to share, you know, on an almost daily basis that are exciting and kind of complement this whole theme and this whole idea that I live, or I'm trying to live my life by, and the whole album concept. So I just thought I'd give it a try. And you know, it's funny how whenever you start to think about something, you know, when you're car shopping, you start looking for cars, and all you ever notice on the street are the cars that you're interested in.
Yeah,
that's kind of the experience right now. You know, I go through my day and, you know, I come across a really awesome YouTube video that's just mind-blowing, or I come across an artist or a person who's just doing their entrepreneurial thing and just kicking it, you know, and I'm just like, this person needs to, someone needs to tell someone about this person. So it's just kind of been cool, you know. It's the blog talks about all or nothing ideas, talks about people who are living an all or nothing life, and just kind of covers all ends of the spectrum.
The last thing I want to ask you about is on the subject of kind of getting out of your way and letting yourself explore ideas that end up paying dividends. And that is something that you referenced a couple of minutes ago, which is Grassrootsy, which I mm-hmm. think is a really cool thing you've done. This organization that offers marketing insight for indie artists, and I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, it was probably about 4 or 5 months after leaving my publicist job, and I just felt like I had all this information in me and no one to kind of to invest it in anymore, no one to share it with, and I would be playing shows with artists, you know, on a regular basis. And after the show, they'd be like, well, you know, would you want to meet up for coffee? I would love to talk to you about this or that and how I can do this better. And I just felt like I was a broken record, that I just kept repeating myself over and over again. It was like, this is how you promote a show, and this is how you build your fan base, and just little things here and there. And it got to the point where I was just like, I think I just need to write a blog, because I'm sure if this person is having this question, that there are hundreds and thousands of other artists out there who are wondering the same thing. And it's just been really cool just to see the readership grow over the years, and to be able to be on the road and meet people who read the blog. You know, that's kind of cool. You know, I'll split a show with someone and they'll be like, you write Grassrootsy? And I'm just like, yeah, you read Grassrootsy? and so, yeah, that's really been cool. But, you know, it's really a labor of love. And the only reason it exists is just to help artists be able to handle the other side of their art, which is the marketing and the business aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, as the industry changes, I think an emerging lament among industry folks that we talk to and a lot of publicists that we talk to is that a lot of artists don't, it isn't that necessarily they don't understand how to do this stuff, although they really don't, but the real problem is that they don't want to, that all mm-hmm. they want to do is make the music and have somebody else take care of the other stuff. And do you find that that's the case?
Oh, hands down. Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I was in this place 7-8 years ago where I needed art for shows, and you know, I kept asking my brother. He was like Photoshop guru, and I was like, can you just make this poster for me, please? And you know, after a while he lost interest, and I was like, okay, Joy, you gotta learn Photoshop, because if you don't know how to use Photoshop, you're gonna have to pay someone every time you need help.
Right.
And so I think that's just where artists are finding themselves. You know, if they don't want to do it, they honestly don't have to, but they have to be rich because they're going to have to pay someone to do it. So, you know, very few people, well, actually no one on our independent music level is rich and making music. But I think it's just one of those things where we as artists have to bite the bullet and learn how to be DIY artists and learn how to do those things that won't get done unless we learn to do them.
Joy Ike has been our guest today here on the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour, and as she made a sly reference to, joyike.com is the place where you should be going to get all of the details about her upcoming events, shows that you should go see, things that you should buy, including her new album, All or Nothing, and things that you don't even know about yet that you should buy. JoyIke.com is the place to find all of that stuff. And we're just so appreciative that Joy could spend some time with us today. And it's been, you know, so much fun. And boy, what else to say besides, you know, Jeff, hope that it starts like raining in New Hampshire and rains for the rest of the day. That's about all I can think of.
It's actually about to start raining, you son of a bitch.
Well, thank you so much, Joy.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun.
Thank you.